Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Maria Mazziotti-Gillen. Maria Mazziotti-Gillen is the recipient of the 2014 George Garrett Award for Outstanding Community Service in Literature from AWP. Also, the 2011 Barnes & Noble Writers for Writers Award from Poets and Writers, and the 2008 American Book Award for her book, All That Lies Between Us, published by Guernica Editions. She is the founder, executive director of the Poetry Center at Passaic County Community College in Paterson, New Jersey, and editor of the Paterson Literary Review. She's also director of the Creative Writing Program and professor of poetry at Binghamton University, SUNY. Gillen has published 20 books. Her most recent are the poetry and art collection, The Girls in the Chartreuse Jackets, Ancestor Song, published by Bordighera Press, Writing Poetry to Save Your Life, How to Find the Courage to Tell Your Stories, published by Miraland Guernica, and the bilingual poetry collection, In a Place of Flowers and Light, poems in English and Italian, with a preface by Elisabetta Marino, edited by Osvaldo Morocco, published by San Moro and Mia Mama. Hi, Maria. How are you?
Fine. Thanks, Jan.
Yeah.
Great to be here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, we're so happy that you're back. You've been on Prosody before, but we're really happy to have you. And as I've said before, when I read your bio saying that Gillen has published 20 books, I'm still astounded every time. So congratulations for all this amazing accomplishment.
I don't know. I think I'm just compulsive. I have to keep writing, and I have no choice.
Okay, so you're going to start with a poem?
Yes. This poem is called Growing Up Italian, and feel free to substitute any other ethnicity or race for Italian that you like. When I was a little girl, I thought everyone was Italian, and that was good. We visited our aunts and uncles, and they visited us. The Italian language smooth and sweet in my mouth. In kindergarten, English words fell on me thick and sharp as hail. I grew silent, the Italian word balanced on the edge of my tongue, and the English word lost during the first moment of every question. It did not take me long to learn that dark-skinned people were greasy and dirty. Poor children were even dirtier. To be dark-skinned and poor was to be dirtiest of all. Almost every day, Mr. Landgraf called Joey a spaghetti bender. I knew that was bad. I tried to hide by folding my hands neatly on my desk and being a good girl. Judy, one of the girls in my class, had honey blonde hair and blue eyes. All the boys liked her. Her parents and grandparents were born in America. They owned a local tavern. When Judy's mother went downtown, she brought back coloring books and candy. My mother went downtown. She brought back one small brown bag with a towel or a sheet in it. The first day I wore my sister's hand-me-down coat, Isabel said, "That coat looks familiar. Don't I recognize that coat?" I looked at the ground. When the other children brought presents for the teacher at Christmas, embroidered silk handkerchiefs, and Evening in Paris perfume, I brought dishcloths made into a doll. I read all the magazines that told me my blondes have more fun, described girls whose favorite color was blue. I hoped for a miracle that would turn my dark skin light, that would make me pale and blonde and beautiful. So I looked for a man with blonde hair and blue eyes who'd blend right in, who'd give me blonde, blue-eyed children who'd blend right in, and a name that would blend right in. And I'd be melted down to a shape and a color that would blend right in. Till one day, I guess I was 40 by then, I woke up cursing all those who taught me to hate my dark, foreign self. And I said, here I am with my olive-toned skin and my Italian parents and my old poverty real as a scar on my forehead. And all the toys we couldn't buy, all the words I didn't say, all the downcast eyes and folded hands and remarks I didn't make rise up in me and explode onto paper like firecrackers, like meteors. And I celebrate my Italian-American self, rooted in this my country, where those black, brown, red, yellow, olive-skinned people soon will raise their voices and sing this new anthem. Here I am, and I'm strong, and my skin is warm in the sun, and my dark hair shines, and today I take back my name and wave it in their faces like a bright red flag. And I'm going to read a poem called 90s, and I write a lot. I really didn't realize it. It's been a slow process, but I write a lot about social class, and I realized how much I didn't know about class markers, things my daughter who went to Georgetown calls class markers. I didn't even know there were such a thing as class markers. Anyway, 90s. At my bridal shower, someone gave me a pink see-through nightgown and pink satin slippers with slender heels and feathers. The gown had feathers on it, too. I've always hated my legs, and even then, when I was still thin and in good shape, I didn't want to wear that nightgown or slippers, didn't want to parade in front of you like some pinup. But I wore them anyway, all those negligees I got as shower presents, sleazy nylon I didn't know was tacky. In all the young years of our marriage, I wore a different nightgown every night, not that it ever stayed on for long, and afterwards I'd pull it back on, afraid our children would find me naked in our bed. I felt so sophisticated in those nightgowns, like the ones Doris Day wore in movies. Only years later, when my daughter buys me a nightgown made of soft and smooth booth silk, do I realize the first ones I owned were cheap imitations of this, the one I hold now to my cheek. Grateful to have been once what I was. How lucky I am to have loved you in nylon, in silk, in my own incredible skin. And I'm going to read a poem called What I Can't Face about someone I love. And I'll say that my son is an arch conservative and a lawyer, and I love him. However, we have a lot of different ideas about politics. What I can't face about someone I love. That my son loves me, but would prefer not to see me too much. Every Sunday night, when I call him in North Carolina, where he lives with his wife and two children, I can hear the heaviness in his voice, his hello tempered with impatience, our conversation stiff and stilted, though we think I can talk to a stone. Strangers in buses and trains tell me their life histories. Acquaintances tell me about their affairs and shattered marriages, show me the secret undersides of their lies. My graduate students vie for my attention. They want to sit next to me and carry my bags and fetch my lunch. But my son can't wait to get off the phone with me. I ask him how the kids are or specific questions about school, ask about his wife, his job. He answers with one or two words. They're fine or okay or the same. My son is a lawyer. He's always brilliant with language, at least written language, and he can read a 300-page book in an hour and remember every detail. But with me, he turns mute as a stump. If I ask for help with some legal problem, he will give it, but I do not hear in his voice the lilt I hear in my daughter's voice when I call her. Instead, I hear reluctance, as though his attention were focused on some truly fascinating person, and he can't wait to get off the phone. I tell stories that I hope will amuse him, but finally, after struggling and finding no response, I can't wait to hang up. I say, "Well, John, have a good week. Give everyone a hug for me." I know my son has divorced me, somewhere deep inside himself in a place he doesn't look at. I am too much for him, too loud, too dramatic, too frantic, too emotional. I laugh too much. I wear him out in a minute and a half. If he never saw me again, he wouldn't miss me. And this is what I can't face about someone I love.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Maria Mazziotti Gillen, reading her poetry. Maria, I wanted to ask you about everything, but, you are truly, you know, one of the truth tellers of our time. And in your poems, you reach down deep for what's real. And I want to ask you how you got the courage to do that in your poetry? Because I know that's very hard to do, and there's a lot of writers out there who can't get there or who won't go there.
Well, I was kind of a coward myself to start out with, so I can't fault other people for being afraid to go there. For me, it was a slow process, and I think there's a kind of shame that's buried very deep inside us, and a kind of don't talk about that. Don't talk about that outside of the house. Don't tell people your secrets. Don't show this parts of your life that are not beautiful. My daughter accused me once of practicing selective memory. And I think she was very right. I was practicing selective memory because there were things that I couldn't face in my own life. I was maybe 40 years old and my first book was published. It won awards. It was really very imitative of the work I'd been reading. It was full of references to Greek gods. I was trying to prove how smart I was. I didn't want people to think, who's this dopey girl from the ghetto with that terrible accent? Who's this person? So I wanted them to think I was smart, and I was afraid to be the person I really was. And then in graduate school, a professor said to me, you know, it's really in this poem about your father that you find the story you have to tell. And in a way, that gave me the first little bit of courage. But it really took me, I have a poem about my father, something I did to him when I was 17, and I was 50 before I had the courage to write that poem. Mm-hmm. It's a very slow process to get there. I have a poem called I Never Tell People about the moments in our long marriage. I love my husband very much, but in any marriage I sometimes think some of the ups and downs of marriage are part of what keeps the spark going. And however, there were things about our relationship that it was hard for me to face at some point. So for me to be able to write about that was really freeing. It was really freeing to write about leaving my father on the corner in January in the cold because of an American boyfriend. Mm-hmm. It was hard. But I try to do that. I try to make myself go there, even when I'm scared. And I'm scared very often. Mm-hmm. But for me, the poems I want to read are poems that make the hair on the back of my neck stand up, that make me cry or make me laugh. I think poetry is rooted in the body and that you have a physical reaction to it when it works. And I want people to have a physical reaction to my work.
Mm-hmm. And we do. Could you read the father poem that you're referring to?
Yeah. And believe me, this was a very, very hard poem for me to write. Daddy, we called you Daddy when we talked to each other in the street, pulling on our American faces, shaping our lives in Patterson slang. Inside our house, we spoke a Southern Italian dialect mixed with English, and we called you Papa. But outside again, you became Daddy, and we spoke of you to our friends as my father. Imagine we're speaking of that father knows best TV character in his dark business suit, carrying his briefcase into his house, retreating to his paneled den, his big living room and dining room, his frilly aproned wife who greeted him at the door with a kiss. Such space and silence in that house. We lived in one big room, living room, dining room, kitchen, bedroom, all in one, dominated by the gray oak dining table around which we sat talking and laughing, listening to your stories, your political arguments with your friends. Papa, how you glowed in company light, happy when the other immigrants came to you for help with their taxes or legal papers. It was only outside that glowing circle that I denied you, denied your long hours as night watchman at Royal Machine Shop. One night, riding home from a date, my middle-class American boyfriend kissed me at the light. I looked up and met your eyes as you stood at the corner near Royal Machine. It was nearly midnight, January, cold and windy. You were waiting for the bus, the street light illuminating your face. I pretended I did not see you, let my boyfriend pull away, leaving you on the empty corner, waiting for the bus to take you home. You never mentioned it, never said you knew how often I lied about what you did for a living, or that I was ashamed to have my boyfriend see you, find out about your second shift work, your broken English. Today, remembering that moment, still illuminated in my mind by the street lamp's gray light, I think of my own son and the distance between us greater than miles. Papa, silk worker, janitor, night watchman, immigrant Italian. I honor the years you spent in menial work, slipping down a ladder as your body failed you, while your mind so quick and sharp longed to escape. Honor the times you got out of bed after sleeping only an hour to take me to school or pick me up. The warm bakery rolls you bought for me on the way home from the night shift. The letters you wrote to the editors of local newspapers. Papa, silk worker, janitor, night watchman, immigrant Italian. Better than any father knows best father, bland as white rice. With your wine press in the cellar. With the newspapers you collected out of garbage piles to turn into money you banked for us. With your mouse traps, with your cracked and calloused hands, with your yellow teeth. Papa, dragging your dead leg through the factories of Patterson. I am outside the house now, shouting your name.
Great poem.
Thanks.
You talk about, very often you talk about your life, the poem. And, you know, I know there's a lot of crafting and revision that goes into your work. And I'm assuming that you're willing to change details and change autobiographical details that have gone into your poems. Am I right about that?
Change details?
Yeah.
I probably don't change details. I spend so long hiding and being shy and afraid of everything. I don't really change details. I mean, my family might not be too happy about that, but I don't change. I do struggle over a word or is this the right word? Is this the right image to try to convey what I mean? Am I remembering this correctly?
Mm-hmm.
It's just an example of selective memory. And, you know, what am I doing? What am I leaving out? What am I afraid of in this poem?
Or things like conversation or what someone was wearing 40 years ago. I mean, things that one couldn't remember particularly, perhaps.
Strangely, I mean, I can't remember what I did yesterday. I swear, I cannot remember. I forget names. The past is so clear to me. I try to tell my students this, that somehow or other, the past, the farther away you are from it, the clearer it becomes. And there are images that stay in your head. Like, I can still see my father's face lit by that streetlight. I can still see it as though he were standing here. And he died when he was 92, and he's already dead almost 20 years. So, but I can still see his face very clearly. There are things that I remember that stay with me. And then things that I might guess at. I might forget somebody's name.
Sure.
You know, I might forget the name of my fifth grade teacher, but I remember the way she'd walk down the aisle and put her hand on my shoulder.
Sure.
I remember that. I remember her face. But I've probably forgotten her name.
Okay. Could you read some more poems?
Sure. I think that sometimes I have, as I've worked on my poetry and as I've tried to get to a place where I'm happy in my poems or with my poems, what I've tried to do is to not worry about revealing too much about my life and not trying to make a life that really didn't exist. And so for me, that was a very hard thing for me to do. Anyway, I want to read a poem about my husband because my husband had early onset Parkinson's disease, and it took him a very long time to die, I have to say. And there's a lot of mixed up things about taking care of somebody for a long time. There are a lot of difficulties about that. And so what ends up happening is that you want to say you're perfect and you want to say that you're not really selfish and all the rest of it. But for most of us, we really are quite selfish, and it's hard for us to sacrifice ourselves for somebody else. And so one of the things I try to write about is what it's like to have somebody ill for a long time. And no matter how much you love the person, how difficult it is. And I'm going to read a poem that's a little embarrassing. My daughter comes home to take care of her sick father. I call home. My daughter says he's doing fine. Here, he's getting ready to sleep. Talk to him. He sounds distant and confused. He has forgotten where I am. I tell him, he says, when will I be going? Where, I ask him. He mumbles, can't find the words to explain. Go to sleep now, I whisper. I love you. Tears push at the back of my eyes. When my daughter gets back on the phone, she says, he wants you to know he loves you too. I do not understand how love could become so complicated. I am ashamed that some part of me wants this to end, to just stop, that increasingly I'm planning his funeral, though even that is confused and fraught with guilt. How can I love him and at the same time want him to die so I won't have to be responsible anymore? What shame I feel. What kind of person am I who could love him, and now that he's in a wheelchair, now that he wears a diaper and needs to be washed and fed, now that he has forgotten how to sit down or answer the phone, now that he is losing his mind, now that he's become more like a baby than a husband, that in my darkest cave, I could wish him dead. The funeral over, the house no longer smelling like a nursing home, no longer full of too many people, and I, with the house sold, living in a condo where I can shut the door behind me, safe and quiet and alone.
If you just tune in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Maria Mazziotti-Gillen, reading her poetry. And you got emotional reading that poem.
I did, and it was horrible. I guess I haven't read it before, and so I really did kind of lose it in the middle. I'm sorry.
Well, no. It was, you know, it's very touching that, you know, you know, obviously, you know, the feelings are so real in your poems and real for the listener also. So thank you for reading it.
Thanks, Jan.
I wanted to ask you about details. I mean, details in your work are so essential, I think, because it seems like no matter what you're writing about in your poems, there's concrete details, and there's a world that's created through them, and it becomes, you know, there's never an issue with clarity, there's never an issue with where are we or what's going on, and I wonder if you could talk, I mean, to maybe some new writers or young writers out there who don't believe in the power of clarity or details. And
well, don't you think that poetry, in order to work, has to be clear? To me, it has to be clear. And it took me a long time to realize that. I was covering up with a lot of excess detail, not specific detail, but references to Greek gods and other things that I thought made me sound smart. And I feel that sometimes young writers think that if they're not clear, it's better, it's more intellectual. Mm-hmm. And I think that in clarity and in those details, and it's something that I learned really from Allen Ginsberg, that if you are honest in looking at the world around you, and you really look at the world around you with your own eyes and find the details that are important to you and that you see in your own life and in the people around, in the things and people around you, that you can create a world in your poetry. But if you're not willing to go to the place where you're actually being honest about what you see, and you're trying to create a world, which I was trying to do in my first book, that I thought other people wanted to see.
Mm-hmm. And you said you won a lot of awards for that book.
Yeah, I did. And it's because people, you know, it was unfrightening. It was full of nice little references and beautiful little images and mm-hmm. all the rest of it. So, you know, that made it win awards.
But you weren't seduced by the awards.
I want to make people cry or laugh or make the hair on their arm stand up. It doesn't always happen, but that's my aim. And my aim is to be as honest as I can be. Mm-hmm. And the details for me are important. And I always go back to Kaddish. And I think, you know, Ginsberg told details in that poem and put in details that make it so that even 40 years since I last read the poem, I can still remember the details.
Yeah, for our listeners, you're referring to Kaddish by Allen Ginsberg, a poem about his mother. Was he your teacher?
No. He was very supportive of the Poetry Center. He came to the Poetry Center quite a bit to do readings. And he was very important to me in terms of looking at his work. Also, a lot of women poets who were just a little bit older than I am were very important to me. Giving me courage to say, I can tell a story about being a woman. I can tell a story about what it's like to get up in the middle of the night and be alone in a house for the one moment when nobody needs you.
And you've talked about Anne Sexton.
Well, Anne Sexton, more importantly, Audrey and Rich was very important to me in that because she went through the same thing, I think, in having young children and trying to claim a life for herself in the midst of a busy household and trying to find that space.
Right. Could you read some more?
Sure. Going to the movies in Kansas City. I love the smell of popcorn. The salt and butter taste of the hot popped corn. The barrel of it we carried into the theater where we'd grab handfuls from the cardboard container and crunch our way through Play It Again, Sam or Annie Hall. You and I holding buttery hands in the darkened theater when we were still young, our children sleeping, the babysitter watching, and we off on our own to the movies. We went to the movies every week. Crying through the pawnbroker and midnight cowboy. The theater still huge, as when, like when I was a child, maroon velvet drapes on the walls, cherubs carved into sconces, crystal chandeliers. The film's recreating a world that for us had been torn apart by Vietnam, dead bodies of young men unloaded in bags from planes, funerals at Arlington, mothers accepting folded flags in place of their children. We wanted the world to change, knew this was a war we didn't believe in, though we were just old enough, you didn't have to go. After the movie, we emerged into the Kansas City night, your arm around me as we walked to our car where we talked about the movie and what it made us feel. We could not imagine what would happen to us or the world, though we thought we knew everything. I'm going to read a poem. I was the girl who never spoke. I was the girl who never spoke, the shy girl, my head perpetually bent, my eyes averted. The other night at the bookstore, I see the new Dick and Jane books on a display shelf. I immediately remember how much I wanted to be part of that Dick and Jane world, the big white house, the huge lawn, the upper middle class father with his cardigan and pipe. In first grade, I loved to look at the pictures in those readers, the books offering me a window into a world so different from my own Italian neighborhood, the streets of Riverside, lined with two or three family houses, statues of Virgin Mary, of the Virgin Mary, and a grotto in the front yards of the newer hilltop houses. No front yard at all in the ones like ours, roses climbing trellises, vegetable gardens crammed full of corn and tomatoes, zucchini and peppers, fig trees, grapevines. In first grade, I didn't know that the distance between Jane's big white colonial and our apartment could be traced in more than miles. I was the girl who never spoke, afraid I'd speak in Italian instead of English, afraid, as I sometimes am even today, that some expression common to Riverside or some way of pronouncing a word will let everyone know where I come from, where I belong, where I can never go.
It's the poetry of Maria Mazziotti Gillen. Thank you so much, Maria. That was great.
Oh, thank you, Jan. You're wonderful.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.